Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is the very accomplished pianist Zach Buerken. Buerken has given solo and chamber music recitals in Europe and throughout the United States. He's the pianist of the Los Angeles Piano Quartet and is an associate professor of music at Cornell University. Welcome to the show, Zach.
Thanks. Pleasure.
Now, I want to talk about your early days in music. Was piano your destiny from young childhood?
We had a very old upright out in the garage. I grew up in Santa Barbara, California. And just, I mean, it was missing parts, missing all the key tops. And I think I just went out and started playing and improvising. And then my parents asked me if I wanted lessons. And I was kind of excited and wore a tie. And
really?
So, yeah, I mean, I was really into it. I luckily had parents who didn't push and have to nag too much.
Yeah, so you just took to it naturally. Now, was there a point in your I assume you took music lessons after that.
Yeah, at, like age five until, you know, finishing my doctorate. So, yeah, forever.
But I was wondering if there was a time when your music teacher or teachers decided that you had real talent and they told you and your parents that?
I guess it would be somewhat early on in the sense that I gave my first sort of full recital, which I can't really believe now, at age 10, which was, you know, a full hour and a half of music memorized and the whole thing. So I guess it appears kind of early. I think about it because now I have children and I don't want to push, but I don't want to, you know, I want to see if there's something there.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not sure how you identify these things.
Yeah, so about age 10 is when you decided that you probably had talent, too.
Yeah,
or is that right? Or
I don't know if I was aware of it, but yeah, something like that.
Uh-huh. Wow, that's quite amazing. So I would say you were a prodigy then.
No, well, I don't know. I mean, I wasn't one of these people who had a big career when they were young. I mean, locally in Southern California I played, but... But luckily, I didn't go through the exposure and burnout thing, so
uh-huh.
That was good.
And so did you just concentrate on classical music, or were you a kid in Southern California? My goodness.
Yeah, right.
Did you get into rock music at all, too?
Well, it's funny. I've been thinking a lot about the kind of music I was exposed to. I had a really creative first teacher who would just have me improvise a lot, and I think that's really a wonderful way to go. And as it turns out, I'm thinking that this coming year I'm spending a year abroad in Amsterdam, and I'm thinking the one thing, amongst others, that I really want to return to is writing my own music and improvisation, because I feel like that gets to a kind of core of the way you express yourself that's really essential, that's not been a part of, quote, most classical musicians' approach,
mm-hmm.
You know, because most of the time we're interpreting texts all the time.
Yeah.
And that's one of the difficulties and drawbacks of being a classical musician versus a pop musician, where you can really just start from a clean slate, is that there's this mid-range. You're in the middle as an interpreter, right? Because you're supposed to recreate something.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking that maybe in the end every performer should be moving towards composing on some level. And I think this is becoming more and more prevalent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that too. I don't know if I see it so much in classical, but I certainly see why it would be advantageous.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. Now, do you remember a point in your life when you went from practice, and learn the techniques to when it really did become an art for you and a way for you to express yourself?
No, I've always regretted that. And in some ways, have a more rigorous, you know, practice certain kind of technical background. But I think I always had teachers who taught me through the music. In other words, it didn't isolate technical things separate from the music, and they were always dealing with character, the character of the music and qualities of sound, things that in a way I was lucky to have such good training, so I didn't think of that as a
it wasn't
boundary,
a separate thing.
Yeah.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, who were the composers that actually inspired you as you were coming up?
Well, it shifted over time. I've always loved Brahms's music. I'm sort of thinking a lot about Schubert because of his kind of duality he has between a kind of spiritual element and a kind of really down-to-earth joy that's really amazing that could exist in one person. And I've been thinking about what kind of music. I've had some time this summer, you know, away from my academic job.
Uh-huh.
So I've been thinking about what kind of music is it that really excites me, and it's either the extreme of a very extroverted music that's quite often kind of American and has a great pulse, and it's fun, it's bouncy, it's shiny. You know, pieces like composer John Adams, he's a wonderful person in this regard. And then the other extreme is the extreme subjective, personal, somewhat tortured world.
Name somebody in
well,
the realm.
Well, this Hungarian composer that I wrote my dissertation on and who I'll play for again next year, Georgi Kurtág. Uh-huh. Very small pieces that are sort of fragments that are like pages torn from a diary of his life. So they're really autobiographical. But they force you, in the way that they're written, to really dig deep and really slow down. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, these are kind of inspiring living people for me.
Uh-huh. And when someone approaches you to play on a CD or play a live performance, how do you decide whether you want to tackle the music that they're proposing?
Yeah, some of it is just, well, if I can create my own project, then I just choose what I'm really passionate about at that time. Mm. But a lot of it is playing with others. I do a lot of chair, most of what I do is chair music. Mm-hmm. And projects come up, and I don't try to do anything that I detest. On the other hand, you do things that you're maybe not so super thrilled about, and that's just part of any working, I guess, musician's thing. Mm-hmm. You can only be choosy to a certain point.
So you take almost on almost anything?
Is that what you're saying? Well, I mean, also in an academic position, you want to support young composers, and so since I do a lot of new music, you know, some of it's going to be not so good, and you don't necessarily know that going in, but it takes a lot of time. Most new music is pretty, you know, heavy investment of time.
Oh, yeah, that's what I would assume, too.
So sometimes that can be frustrating. So I'm kind of happy the next year is just I'm just doing whatever I want and nothing more. So,
oh, that's great. Yeah. That's great. I want to play a sample from an upcoming solo CD that you're going to be coming out with next year. To tell us a little bit about it, the title and the piece that we're going to listen to.
The title of the CD will be Horse with a Lavender Eye. And I was trying to remember why it's called that. Well, there's a trio that's on. It's actually not all soul music. There's a trio on it with that title. The composer is Stephen Hartke, who's Californian, teaches at USC, University of Southern California. He's just coming back from winning the Ives Fellowship, which is they pay you $1 billion not to work so you can compose. Mm-hmm. So he's doing very well, and this is music that has a definite American feel to it. But it's also very complex and multi-layered. The first piece I think you're going to play is the second movement from the sonata, which is very jazzy. It reminds me a lot of Gene Kelly, a kind of tip-tap-toe kind of stuff. Yeah.
Let's listen to it. Wow, that piece has a lot of energy. You're not kidding, it sounds like an American piece.
Yeah.
And then why do we identify that? Do we still identify America with a lot of energy?
We identify it with a kind of jazzy syncopation with brash kind of extroversion. I mean, that's totally simplified. But yeah, I think that's part of it. You're not going to hear that from a European composer, other than maybe people who are strongly influenced by American rock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you've transitioned from just doing classical, and you do jazz-sounding piano, too.
Well, it's jazz-sounding, but it's not strictly jazz. I would hate to.
Do you do jazz at all or not?
I don't. I would say I can fake it a little bit, but it's such a, you know.
It's a different genre.
Yeah, it just takes an enormous amount of investment,
uh-huh.
And I admire it enormously. I grew up with that. My father was a great jazz collector, LPs, so I grew up with that in my ear.
But you identify in the realm of the classical.
Yeah, I suppose. Although I think it's changing. I mean, when someone asks me, you know, who doesn't know me, what do you do? What kind of music do you play? And I say classical. I'm always a little bit, I don't want to say embarrassed, but I know that immediately pigeonholes me in such just a strong way in American culture. And
yeah, well, they think of it as a dusty old, you know,
right.
world
yeah.
and an old, you know.
And I think that's changing. I mean, just yesterday it was announced the new music director of the New York Philharmonic is someone who's quite young.
He's only 40, I heard that.
Yeah, and it's funny, it's like only 40. Well, that's actually middle-aged, but he's American, and he's not 70, so that's a big step forward.
Well, what do you think about some of the composers that are out there? Stephen Levine looks like he's on his deathbed half
right,
the time.
Right.
These guys are really having long careers.
Right. I mean, L.A. Phil just hired Gustavo Dudamel, who's 26. So, I mean, finally people are starting to make, it seems to me, right now, is a time when people are making the right choices of saying, listen, we need a younger audience, we need to go for that audience, we need people from different cultures, we need, you know what I mean? So it's it's kind of heartening.
And then once it takes, you won't have to be embarrassed telling people that
right.
you're in classical
exactly.
music.
Yeah, right.
Now, I've heard it said that she'll never be a serious pianist because although she has great technical skills, she doesn't have the passion or the emotion. Do you think that part of it is really necessary to be a great pianist?
Sure, you need. I mean, I don't know if it has to do with playing piano at all. It's just being a musician. You need a certain world experience, and I think the certain route for classical musicians, let's say from the 1930s to 1980s, was always this standard route of entering competitions, winning this, meeting this person, and it was kind of standardized to the point where it became rather clinical, I think, and it's we've gotten away from that, which is great because. Having judged some competitions, I see that the problem is always the extremes get knocked out, and you get a kind of middle-of-the-road, sometimes safe choice, which you don't even necessarily want.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully, more and more, as people are using the internet and as people self-producing albums, it's not a more about pleasing certain people in power. It's having an original voice, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And being able to find the creativity above just the technical level,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I've often wanted to ask a pianist this. Does your mindset change a lot between when you're rehearsing something and when you're out there performing in regard to the piece?
Yeah, I think what there is in a performance is an awareness of space because you are playing to an audience and you are aware of the energy in that room. And you in those split moments can decide, well, I'm going to go for it here, or I'm going to lay back here. So probably the sense of timing and the amplitude of intensity. I mean, that's the funny thing. Like when you do a recording session and you set the sound, you say, oh, play me something loud so we can set the sounds in the mic. And you play it, and it's like moderately loud. And then you play it in performance, and it's much stronger. And I think it's just being so jolted with the inspiration of that moment.
Uh-huh. If you're just joining us, my guest is Zach Bjurken. He's a pianist and a music professor at Cornell University. Now, we were talking about Europe and the United States and people in Europe react differently. How different are the audiences there?
Well, 6 years ago, I lived in Amsterdam and then Berlin, where my son was born. And my wife plays in Germany a lot and Japan. Now, those are two places where classical music is still very much a central part of the culture, and where young people still go to concerts.
Mm.
And so when you play for those audiences, there's a sense of, well, this is still an act of culture, and what you're doing is still relevant, and people understand that language in a stronger way. It's assumed in a stronger way than they do here. Of course, it still exists here, but I think that's what needs to happen is a kind of... Well, I've been thinking about the internet as a as a way of and iPods, you know, people download everything, including classical music, mm-hmm. and they listen mm-hmm. to it side by side with rap and with everything else. And there's a positive part to this, which is that people can get turned on to music they didn't know, because they don't have to go through those social conventions of being dressed up and going to this.
Exactly, yeah.
The negative part is that it all becomes equalized into a kind of equal relevance. And maybe it is, and maybe sometimes there's stuff that you have to be in a performance setting to understand, that kind of visceral impact. Hmm. And so I think that's our responsibility, is to try to reach out to people and invite them in.
Well, why do you think that the reaction is different in Europe? And is it a different education system in regard to music?
Yes.
And
I think that's
the major reason. Huh?
Yeah. Plus, I mean, if we think of classical music, then in Germany specifically, that's been going on. They've had such a history of great people that, yeah, everyone knows this music still,
mm-hmm.
which is very different than here. I mean, I think the two countries right now who spend the most music on money as a government on education are Finland, and you see all those Finnish composers and conductors and pianists coming out now, and Venezuela.
Really?
Yeah, in which Dudamel, this conductor of the LA Phil, is from. And I just went on YouTube last night and watched this young orchestra from Venezuela, and I was just floored by the level and the intensity, because they spend a lot of money and they educate these people, and they're all playing these instruments, and it was like watching a rock concert, because the people in the orchestra were moving in such a dynamic way and getting so involved, and it was really impressive.
Wow, that's quite amazing.
Yeah.
But you know, there is the demise of the arts just in general in this country.
Yeah.
We don't put money into it. We take it out, in fact, in the last seven years. So I think that's probably the difference too. You remember in the Netherlands, they were even paying artists for their work.
Right, and they have, you know, how many radio orchestras? I mean, they had so many orchestras and so many choirs, and they pay for you to record on the radio. I mean, it's just kind of amazing.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a well-known musician, accomplished musician that you are, do you feel like it's your responsibility in some way to take classical music out into the 21st century for this country?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I've always, when I put together programs, I try to mix quite new music. And my goal is then actually to include stuff I've written, but mm-hmm. I'm not... Mm-hmm. I have to work on my courage in that way. with older reps, so that they kind of shine a light on each other as far as how they can dialogue in the program itself.
How do you make classical music hip? I mean, isn't that what it comes down to get young people involved in some way?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is it's not just, you know, dressing in jeans and performing at a certain time, which has been one approach. I don't think you can dumb down. There's no reason to dumb down, only play sort of light pops and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it probably has to do with going into the schools on a sort of basic level, and then setting up organizations or venues where you somehow make it attractive for people to come, which is why my wife and I are starting this festival next year here called Mayfest.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that in just one moment. But
in
the meantime, let's play another piece from this Horse with a Lavender Eye. Talk to us about this second piece.
It's from a set of short pieces by Stephen Hartke called Postmodern Homages. And this homage is to Erik Satie. So it's he has these famous pieces called Je n'en pédie. And this one's just a lovely, simple piece called Je n'en pédie number 4. So
let's listen. That's beautiful. That's really nice.
Yeah.
Now, as you were saying before we got interrupted by your beautiful music, tell us about the Chamber Music Festival that you're working on for next year.
Yeah, we're going to call it Mayfest. We got some money from Cornell, and I've managed to raise so far from local sponsors to put on, 7 concerts starting May of 2008. Mm. And we're inviting some well-known international guests, principal clarinetist, the Berlin Philharmonic, principal viola, some New York Phil, and this young string quartet whose leader we just hired at Cornell as our violin professor. Mm. So Cornell has been, by chance, hiring some performers on their faculty recently. We have a wonderful new violinist and percussionist. So I thought, wow, here's a department at Cornell that's really famous for musicology and really famous for composition. We have two of really great composers in America at Cornell. And yet performance has always been much smaller and not as well known. So I thought, well, this is an opportunity for us to sort of show our strength in a new way, but also to pay back to the community. Not pay back, but just create something for the community that's really wonderful. And we have so many nice things. You know, May is such a gorgeous time to be here.
Mm-hmm.
I've asked some restaurants and vineyards to be involved. The Carriage House Cafe, which is wonderful performance space upstairs. We're going to use their facility and Barnes Hall on campus. And so it's just a lovely time to come together right after classes and where we can highlight some of the student performances, too, and some of the young composers that have come through Cornell.
Oh, that's great. Well, we will look forward to that for sure.
Yeah.
Now, do you ever question what a composer's thinking about when you're interpreting their music? Do you think in those terms at all?
What they're thinking about, well, I guess you can't know. I mean, a lot of, you know, people can write very joyful music when they're in the depths of despair, mm-hmm. so you can't equate biography with character of music, I don't think. But that is your responsibility, is to find out, to try to look for what maybe is the essence of the character in terms of the sound and the structure and how things relate in terms of time and space, actually, mm-hmm. how you perform things. And that's the nice thing about playing a lot of new music, is that it becomes easy when you're interpreting old texts to become quite self-conscious, because the weight of history is quite enormous. When you play for new, you know, composers who are young, and you play their piece, and they're like, yeah. Well, then you feel, you're like, oh, okay, maybe I am sort of on the right track, and maybe I wouldn't be so different from playing for Schubert or Beethoven. In other words, composers are often, they just are pushing you more in the direction that you feel strongly about, rather than just saying, oh, you know, you're totally clueless. So,
So they open you up in some way.
They do open you up, and I think this idea of being wrong in your interpretation, it's certainly possible to be maybe heading the wrong direction. I mean, when you're teaching students, you try to have them make their own choices in an informed way. But, mm-hmm. You do think a lot about that, what composers are after.
Yeah. And I wanted to bring up the fact that you teach. How do you approach teaching? What's the most important thing that you can tell somebody who's a pianist to be?
It's this combination of digging deep, questioning things in the score that they're learning to read, I guess, and at the same time having them at the end, towards the end of that preparation, before they perform, having them forget that so that they aren't just standing in front of an audience and reciting something from the score.
Mm.
So there's a sense of their personal investment. And that's hard because, you know, I feel a certain confidence in the approach to certain principles of approaching a text, but how do you draw them out? And that has to do a lot with personality and psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And that a lot of my students don't go on to be performers. It's not a
And can you tell? Could you get a sense when you meet somebody who think is going to be really extra special at this?
I think I can. And mostly I'm probably somewhat right on, but sometimes I'm wrong.
Hmm.
And it's really fun to be proven wrong because...
what do you mean it's fun to be proven wrong?
Well, I mean, you know, you're just like, well, gosh, that person, I don't know, you know. When they come into audition, like I always just sit there with Malcolm Bilson, my colleague, and listen to auditions. And Malcolm would always be very generous and say, oh, I'll take that person. I think, oh, well, really? Okay, fine. And then that person would turn out to be, you know, quite wonderful. But yeah, you can generally hear talent right off the bat.
Uh-huh, yeah. Uh-huh. Now, going back to the idea of composing, would you get your ideas from almost anything? Where do you get your ideas from?
Well,
do you know yet?
Yeah, I don't know yet. Well, I mean, I used to be in a group called Mobius, and it was a piano trio. And we would do, we play a standard repertoire, and then we'd do improvisations, and we call them Mobius trips. So they're Mobius trips. And we would just, you know, number the trip. And audiences really loved it because there was a sense of, you know, whoa, being in the moment of some craziness. I have to say, it's a little hard to find people who are willing to take that leap in the moment in the classical music world. I'm finding them, but it's difficult. On the other hand, the responsibilities of being a father and of being a teacher are quite enormous, and so that's why when I have this time off, I'm looking forward to maybe finding some people like that, and also just for myself, getting enough confidence so I can just sit down and improvise, you know, within a certain guideline, mm-hmm. parameter.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to be taking this time off, but as a musician, you really can't stop playing, right?
No, time off actually to have more time to be a musician. Time uh-huh. off from faculty meetings and, you know, from teaching responsibilities.
So you're going to take time off to be more creative.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. And do you think you will start composing during this time off?
I will certainly try. I don't know if it's composing or improvising. I don't know if I'll write it down, but, yeah. Improvising, uh-huh. for sure.
And when you're practicing and keeping yourself in shape musically, what kind of stuff do you play?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, usually you just have a series of concerts, and to be honest, you're just preparing the next thing. You're just... I choose a solo repertoire for each year, probably, and then you have a bunch of chamber music concerts, and you're kind of back-to-back slamming through a bunch of stuff. And when you play with the same people, like with my quartet... Of course, it's wonderful. You get to repeat things over and over, and it gets better and better. That's a real luxury. But a lot of it is one-offs, and that's not ideal. Because, you get to a certain level, and you perform it, and you're like, oh, damn, it wasn't as good as I hoped. And then you hope to return to it, you know. And I'm hoping this next year to just have more space to take things slow.
And are we going to be able to see you perform at all in the next few months, or are you just taking off?
No, I'm taking off in August 15th, and then... Not until next May, for the May Fest, yeah.
Uh-huh. So. And do you practice with your wife? I know your wife's an accomplished musician.
Yeah, she's a wonderful pianist. We've played quite a few recitals together in the last 2 years as two piano concerts. And they're great in performance, and they're just terrible in rehearsal because, you know, it's your wife you're dealing with or your husband. So so rehearsing and arguing is sort of goes hand in hand.
Tell people her name.
Oh, Mary Yampolsky, sorry. Uh-huh. It would be nice if we didn't have to rehearse and just perform.
Well, Zach Bjerken, we have run out of time. I thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
And we will look forward to hearing you perform next year.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by Finger Lakes Arts Grants and Services. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.